accession number 27344, reel 28.
Robert McCandless, reel 28.
Well, talking about the 1027 and my visits to Dunfold, the people down there gave me an awful lot of information about the planned aircraft, the sort of ability of it, its range, its weight carrying capacity and all this sort of stuff. And also they gave me some idea of their intentions of the development from the 1027, which would have been called the 1054. And I drew up a plan for using this type of aircraft by the RAF in army support and by the Fleet Air Arm in doing the jobs that they could do. And it seemed to me that for the RAF, it was a tremendous advantage because their ground attack aircraft at that time was the Hawker Hunter. And the Hunter certainly needed a proper airfield to operate from. But with the Harrier, you could operate from a cattle field quite easily. And what they could do would be to park on the ground behind the frontline troops and just wait there until they were called in without having to fly around and wait there. And it seemed to me that this would be a tremendous advantage, and the only disadvantage was the fact that with the power of the engine that the 1027 had, the lifting capacity with fuel and armament was certainly limited. But it could still have been a useful aircraft. And when it became the 1054, because the development had already started in the minds of the designers, I could see it being very advantageous. And I gave a lecture to my lords and masters in the Central Fighter Establishment about this aircraft and how it could be used in air defence and ground attack. In air defence, it wasn't any good against the really sophisticated fast jets because it was never intended to be supersonic, and it couldn't have been. So in air defence, it wasn't really much of an answer from the point of view of fighter command. But on the other hand, the threat being faced by fighter command wasn't any more from fast jets. It was from intercontinental ballistic missiles and other weapons like that coming in from long range, which none of our fighters could have dealt with anyway, not even the Lightning. So I explained to them in my lecture that I thought the fighter command ought to be preparing itself to be a tactical air force like the American tactical air force. And I did say that, in my view, if there was another world war, fighter command wouldn't be taking part in it. And this wasn't met with any great approval by my lords and masters. And at the end of it all, the Air Commodore told me that the Air Ministry was not interested in vertical and short takeoff aircraft. So I got all my gear together and went to visit my lords and masters in the Admiralty and the Director of Naval Air Warfare Department. And lo and behold, the senior officer of the group that came to listen to my talk was my old enemy, Winkle Brown. Anyway, I gave my talk to, I suppose, about 10 or 12 of the officers in the Directorate of Naval Air Warfare. And I explained to them how this aircraft could be a tremendous advantage and why I thought, because it was likely that future conflict that the Fleet Air Arm would be able to deal with would be limited war and insurrection rather than global war. And I said to them, in global war, the first indication to the Fleet Air Arm that the war has started will be as all the carriers are sunk. because the Russians know where our carriers are better than the Admiralty do. But this didn't go down very well. And after the end of my talk, I was told by the senior officer there that I was never, ever to discuss this subject again with anyone. And I started to argue with him. I said it'd be absolutely ideal in the Fleet Air Arm because you'll be able to remove all the deck landing equipment which is underneath the flight deck and all the catapult equipment which is underneath the flight deck. And instead of the restriction on the number of aircraft being carried is due to the number of men required to maintain them, you'll have all that space for mess decks and get in as many men as you like. Therefore, you can carry as many aircraft as you can pack onto the ship. That argument really did not meet with approval at all. In fact, he lost his temper with me and sent me packing back to West Reenham.
What was his thoughts about the role of the Fleet Air Arm for the future?
Oh, he didn't tell me. Didn't give me any idea at all of the way they were thinking. But I did speak to one of the officers in his staff who was more of my seniority, and he told me at the time that they were still going ahead with the development of the bigger carriers and flying the heavier jets the same as the Americans were going to do, and they were even at that time proposing a nuclear-powered carrier like the enormous ships that the Americans have, like the Eisenhower and things like that. But that was very quickly kicked into touch. So anyway, I went back to West Reenham, and then it so happened that the Central Fighter Establishment was leaving West Reenham and moving to Binbrook in Lincolnshire. And I can remember the tooth-sucking amongst the RAF officers. And to give you an example, there was one senior stores officer in the RAF was bleating to me about moving from West Reenham to Binbrook, which must have been all of 70 miles. And it came out during the course of the conversation that in all his time in the RAF, which was well over 20 years, he'd never been out of East Anglia. I thought, God, I thought of my career and the number of times I hadn't stayed in any one place for more than a year, you know. It really did astonish me. But in fact, that particular man volunteered to leave the RAF because he was being sent abroad. Anyway, that was the winter of 62-63, which it really was a bloody hard winter. And we had continuous frost from just before Christmas until April in Lincolnshire. And the fogs were terrible. I was living at that time in a mobile home. And I was trying to get my mobile home moved from RAF West Reenham to RAF Binbrook. But the CO at Binbrook was absolutely adamant that he would not have caravans or mobile homes on his station. That was it. So I found a local builder in Binbrook who was contemplating using one of the fields he had bought to convert it into a caravan site. And I was encouraging him to get on with that, but he couldn't because the ground was frozen hard and he couldn't do anything at all. So my wife and family had to stay at West Reenham while I was working at Binbrook. And I used to drive up to Binbrook from West Reenham on a Monday, go back home on a Wednesday evening and back on Thursday morning and back home Friday night. And I used to take one of the civilian scientific officers with me backwards and forwards because he was in the same situation. His wife was in West Reenham and he was working in Binbrook. And the drives sometimes were really quite horrendous. I had one of those Riley, I've forgotten the size of the engine, 1.4 or something like that. Lovely car to drive. But, of course, in those days, the heating facilities weren't as good as they are nowadays. And I used to have to put the full heat onto the windscreen to keep the ice off the windscreen. So we were both bloody frozen by the time we got there. But it was a drive we could do quite quickly, because we left in the morning to be back at Binbrook in time to start the day at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, whatever it was. But as far as I was concerned, the naval liaison officer job was a complete waste of time in the Central Fighter Establishment. And when I said so and it got back to the Commodore, he was not best pleased, because it meant that when I left, there was no naval officer going to replace me. So that was that, and I left Binbrook and went to the Admiralty. Did I? Do you know, I can't remember. Yes, that's right, I went to the Admiralty. And I hated that job. I really, really hated it. It was just making up our minds what number of ratings should be operating in each of the ships. And for most of the existing ships, this had been established and proved to be satisfactory, or had been changed if it hadn't been. So the main job was thinking up the number of airmen required in the new big carrier. There were also, at that time, early 1964, we started the review, the naval review, by Dennis Healy, who was Minister of Defence at that time. And there were meetings with great regularity between the Fleet Air Arm representatives, the RAF representatives, and the civil servants and the politicians. And after every meeting, there came back to us a request for information of what would happen if this and what would happen if that. And we had to sit down and burn the midnight oil and recalculate the manning of various ships if things were changed. And this was going on for, some months, actually, while this review went through. And unfortunately, the RAF had people who were better at arguing than the Navy had. And one of the things that the RAF said they could do would be to protect the fleet wherever they were in the world. And, of course, that was a downright lie. But it was to the politicians' advantage to accept it as the truth, because it meant that they could give the money to the RAF and take the money away from the Navy. And that was the intention, as far as we could see. And some of the things that they were talking about, at that time the Americans were building an aircraft called the F-111. And this was the first aircraft with swing-wing capability. Swing wing, if you remember, was where the aircraft could have straight wings for takeoff and swept wings for flying, and it could change from straight to swept while it was airborne. And this aircraft, the RAF was going to buy, and using its capability, they were going to be able to protect the Navy wherever they went. And of course, we were able to show on a map how it was just an impossibility if the Navy was fighting in some remote part of the world, and there were political impossibility for the RAF aircraft to be based within range of the F-111, then there was no cover for the fleet. And as you know, if there's no cover for the fleet, enemy aircraft can sink very big ships very quickly. I mean, if you just take the Repulse, and what was the other one off the Malayan coast? I mean, they were sunk within, two aircraft raids, and they'd gone. So our people doing the arguments in this particular meeting must have been pathetic, because at the end of it all, Dennis Healy said that the fixed-wing flying in the Fleet Air Arm would cease within the next 4 years. So that was by 1968... there would be no more fixed-wing flying in the Fleet Air Arm, and they would concentrate on helicopters for anti-submarine warfare. Well, of course, this didn't go down at all well in the Fleet Air Arm. And in fact, it caused really very considerable recruiting problems for the Fleet Air Arm, because obviously youngsters knew that the Fleet Air Arm was going to be reduced very substantially, and their chances of, first of all, getting into the Fleet Air Arm were very remote, and secondly, their chances of getting advancement were even more remote. So recruitment in the Fleet Air Arm became a major problem. And being in the personnel panel, it also became one of our problems, because the recruiters kept asking us questions which we had to answer the best way we could. And it so happened that when I was talking to someone, they said, well, of course, with the people coming in for recruitment, there are those who are illiterate and innumerate, but also there's a really surprisingly high proportion of the males volunteering for the Navy who are colourblind. So I started to look into this question of colourblindness, and I went to see the medical people, and they gave me quite a lot of information, including that the average colourblindness in Britain amongst the males was 7%. And we were losing nearly 15% of people with colour blindness. So I started to investigate why we were losing twice the number we should. So I started to investigate the way the recruiting doctors were testing for colour blindness. And investigating it, I found that the methods were a bit primitive, to put it mildly. And because they were primitive, there was quite often doubt. And if there was doubt, they said no. So that the numbers who were dipping because of colour blindness were very high. So I went to see some of the, just a couple of friends of mine who were surgeon captains, about this. And they had been friends in the ships that I'd been in with them. And they were absolutely aghast that I should be interfering in anything to do with testing for colour blindness. They said, it's up to us, the doctors, to say who is going to be allowed into the service. And I wrote quite a long paper on this, and I said, in the days when we started testing for colour blindness, we were looking at naval airmen who were looking either with the naked eye or through binoculars at aircraft in the air, and they were directing them how to come and join the ship or how to come in and join an airfield. So looking at it, they had to know which way it was going. So they had to be able to recognise red, green and white. So that was the first and important aspect of colour vision for naval airmen. And I said, nowadays, a naval airman never looks in the air because all the aircraft direction is done by radar and radio, and they don't have to see it until it lands on the deck. So whether they're colourblind or not is not terribly relevant, except for one situation. And in an aircraft carrier, the only time they have to look and see colours is the traffic light signals on the island, which are red, don't take off, green, take off. And to be honest, the naval airmen are not all that interested in it. It's the flight deck officer and the petty officers. But still, they have to have the right colour vision. So I had this long argument with the medical people about my interfering in the discussion of what colour vision was required in the Navy. And I said, this is an executive situation, and we are asking the medical people to help us by giving us the right people with the right degree of colour vision. And it doesn't have to be nearly as accurate as it used to be. Now, I put this paper into a file and put on the file the number of people that I wanted to see it and make comments. And there must have been, I suppose, 14 or 15 people in the Admiralty who had to see this and put their stamp on it and send it round. So I put this into the system, and that meant it went into the registry, and the registry sent it on to the person first on the list. And after a couple of weeks, I went into the registry and I said, can you tell me where this file is? And they said, yes, it went on to that department. I said, can you tell me who in that department? So they looked up their records again and said, yes, it was so-and-so. So I went to that department and asked to speak to whoever it was. And it was absolutely astonishing the number of times that I went into a department, and it was a civil servant, frequently a woman, who was sitting with this at the bottom of a pile of files on her desk, and I would ask them to dig it out and say, can you tell me what you're going to do about this and when? And they said, well, I don't know, I have no idea. I don't know what I want to say about it. I said, well, who's your boss? And is he going to deal with it? Or is she going to deal with it? And he said, well, I don't know, but I can give it to Mr. So-and-so and see what happens. And this was going on, and weeks and indeed months were going by. And I remember going to see one lady, and in this department there must have been, I suppose, 8 civil servants, a lot of clerical officers and one executive officer at the top of it all. And when the clerical officers didn't know what to do with what landed on the desk, they passed it on to the executive officer. And she had behind her a double-fronted cupboard packed full of files. And I had asked around and I found out that it landed on this executive officer's desk. And she was a very busy woman, very, very good, intelligent, quick. I said to her about this file on colour vision for naval airmen. She said, oh, yes, but I haven't given it any priority. And she turned round and opened this double-fronted cupboard. And I was astonished to see the number of files in there. And damn me, she could put her hand straight in and pull it out. And I thought, that is amazing. So she pulled it out and read through it quickly and said, well, what do you want me to see? So I told her what I wanted her answer to be. So she wrote it on and signed it and gave it to me. It was as quick as that. She was delighted. It was another file off her desk. And I went on to another department, and the secretary to the head of the department was a mousy woman. And I'd spoken to her about this file, and she said, yes, she would give it to her boss and tell her boss what I wanted him to write. So seemingly she'd done this, and he wrote what he was required to write, or she wrote it in and he was going to sign it. That's what it was. She wrote it in and he took it in, read it, signed it and sent it back out. And I got it and I read it, and the answer she had written in missed out one word. Not. And of course it was, his answer was the opposite meaning to what I wanted. So I took it back to her and I said, I'm terribly sorry, you've missed out the word not. And she flapped, absolutely, totally flapped. And I said, well, can I go in and see your boss and explain the problem? And she allowed me to go in and see him, so I took it in and put it down in front of him and I said, I'm sorry, but she's left the word not out from there. So she said, oh, put a not and gave it back to me. But that file on colour vision for naval airmen took 14 months to get through the Admiralty. 14 months. And it was the only thing I achieved in the whole of my time in the Admiralty. Oh, what a waste of time it was. But, you know, for example, we had the personnel panel, which was, I think, 14 serving naval officers and 5 civil servants in the administration office for our little group. And it so happened in the summer that year that four of the civil servants decided to go on leave at the same time and left one civil servant in the office. And it was absolutely great, because stuff went through that office so fast and out the other end that we all took advantage of it and passed stuff through, and it went on its way without delays. It was absolutely amazing.
It sounds like it would have taken forever for anything to get through that system.
Oh, and it often got lost. Oh, it often got lost and just didn't, you couldn't find it, you know. The registry said, well, it went to so-and-so, and so-and-so couldn't find it, so it was probably at the bottom of the pile, at the bottom of the cupboard.
And were there lots of, obviously, there were the other serving naval officers, were they all reporting on different aspects of personnel?
Oh, yeah. Not personnel, yes. That would be engineers, air engineers, cooks, stewards, pay, you know. There were all these sort of branches of the service were represented in the personnel panel. And it would have worked very well with one civil servant only, but there were five employees. And the thing that did annoy me, didn't annoy me, but I thought it was sad, was the civil service unions refused to allow outside organisation and methods people to come in and study their activities. There was an organisation and methods team in the civil service, but I think they were dedicated to keeping things as they were rather than changing them to something which was sensible. There were an awful lot of things that went on that I thought were really sad.
So they were spending a lot of their time dedicating it to keeping things the same.
Oh, absolutely.
Rather than in having any change.
Oh, and shuffling paper around in a way which delayed everything. And you had to be fairly insistent to get stuff moving. But in the end, it did go through. But I don't know. I was sad about the whole thing.
With your particular instance with the colour blindness for naval airmen, did you specifically go out of your way to chase that up?
Yes, I did. Well, it dawned on me quite early on that unless I did, it was going to get lost, because none of the civil servants knew what they were supposed to be saying. They didn't know what answer was required at the end of the day or why. And they never put in any arguments to change what had been written in the spiel that I sent them. They just said either agreed and approved or no comment to make or whatever. But they still had to put it in and sign it. And those who were, shall we say, qualified to sign weren't seeing it as quickly as they should.
Who would be qualified to sign that sort of thing?
Oh, usually the executive officer or whatever, not under secretary, it never went as high as that. I can't remember the sort of sequence of seniority of the civil servants, but certainly in a smaller group, the executive officer, and after that it went up to, I've forgotten the names of them, to tell you the truth. But I wasn't impressed with the civil service, I'm afraid. Not at all.
Were your colleagues, the other serving naval officers on the panel, were they as frustrated as yourself?
Yes, but we didn't discuss it much because it didn't get us anywhere. I mean, once we had established that the organisation methods team was going to come and have a look at it, and they came and had a look and left things exactly as they were, we were so disillusioned we just tossed in our hands and left it at that. Because we knew that we weren't going to buck the whole civil service. No way.